me, the idea of a voluntary society is a place where every man, woman, child, being is able to express themselves fully without the threat of force or violence against them for their choices in their own lives. To me, this is also what is known as anarchy. Anarchy coming from two Greek words, and signifying no or without, and arch, meaning government, hence anarchy meaning no government. And in an anarchist society, we would have what is known as voluntarism, the belief in creating a voluntary society without force. The ideas of the non-aggression principle, the ideas that we can all work together and can respect each other and have our own minds and our own ability to take care of ourselves, taking the government out of social interaction and getting rid of this paternalism that we see where the government has control of everything. And to me, it goes deeper than that as well. I mean, recognizing that we have paternal systems that have taken control and we have turned away from the feminine as well, the feminine of paying attention to our planet and to our spiritual side. And so to me, when you start to work towards a voluntary society or an anarchist society, you're really reconnecting back to a closer, more natural state to what we probably experienced in the past. And my research into voluntarism and to create a voluntary society led me towards the idea of agorism. And agorism is basically the idea of anarchy in action. So taking the ideas of self-rule and creating these better systems and actually going out in the world and doing it. So agorism is what I like to think of as once people have decided to stop reading about creating a voluntary society or an anarchist society and stop talking about it and decided to go out in the world and do this. So you look at any problem that we may face in the world, or any situation we're dealing with where there is a state or government option, and try to find ways that you as an individual or the community can do it better. So one of these ways is the food. Right now there's a huge monopoly on our lives, and specifically on what we ingest, what we put into our bodies. Growing your own food is one of the biggest steps towards independence. It lessens the control that the monopolies have on your lives. It lessens the control that the monopolies have on the farmers that are growing food in other countries. And it also helps us localize and focus on what we can do here at home.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another edition of Off Planet TV. Randy's with us, and we have an excellent guest tonight. I'm super excited about this show. So let's get started here. All right. It is clear to anyone who has been watching the circus that is this election cycle that humanity has lost its way. Our guest tonight has committed his life to helping us find our way again. He is the founder of the Houston Freethinkers and the Conscious Resistance Network, owner of Organic Gardens for All, writer at the Anti-Media and Activist Post, and co-host of Addiction Free Radio. He's here tonight to help us break the status paradigm of coercion, domination, and mind control, and plant seeds of peaceful anarchy and voluntarism by building freedom cells and developing pockets of agorism. Derek Brose, welcome to Off Planet TV.
Hey, thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Let's get started by just having you tell everybody who you are and how you got into doing what you're doing.
Sure. I'm always happy to share my personal story because I think that it's absolutely a part of the message that I'm going to share with everyone today. And I'm thankful to try to share my journey and hope that it inspires others. So I'm 31 years old right now. For the past 6 years, I've dedicated as much time as I can reasonably possibly to activism, now to freelance journalism, to a bunch of different community activism projects, being involved in the community here in Houston. And it started for me really in 2005, about 11 years ago, it started with me going through a drug addiction. I was went through stages of being addicted to several drugs, including ecstasy, a number of other things, eventually getting to crystal meth and being addicted to crystal meth and selling crystal meth. And that led me to getting arrested and doing a total of 18 months behind bars over a period of 4 years in and out of lockup and rehabilitation facilities and state institutions and probation, and then eventually on parole with the felony. And I was released for the last time throughout that experience in the October of 2008. So about 8 years ago this month, I was released a month before Obama got elected, which is a really interesting time to get to be getting released, because I wasn't very politically aware at that time, but I was definitely looking for answers. And after getting out and going through that experience, my whole life had been changed. I decided when I was locked up, I decided to do a lot of self-reflection, and I got into meditation. I got into Buddhism, specifically Zen Buddhism, and started to heal, to allow myself to heal from a lot of wounds and things that I dealt with when I was younger, this depression and suicide attempts, and basically not having the tools, the necessary tools to process these issues that I was having. And for me, that led to drug addiction, to, you know, using drugs to try to drown and to ignore the different pains that I was dealing with. And I just didn't feel like I knew how to process that. So whenever I finally decided to do that, when I got behind bars, I really had to stop and reflect. And I have in my family, on the on my real father's side, my birth father's side, there's a history of males with drug addiction problems and alcoholism in prison and a lot of this type of stuff. So for me, it was really a gut check and a time to make a decision on which way I wanted to go, that I'd already seen other family members, my father and my grandparents and other people, struggle with drugs and alcohol and prison, and had to make a decision to decide which way I wanted to take my life, and ultimately decided that I would use the time while I was behind bars. The first time I got locked up in November 2005, I was locked up for 10 months and then, you know, got out shortly after that. But I used that time to get into meditation and to, I had my grandmother send me as much literature as she could on Buddhism and, you know, Zen Buddhism and just meditation in general. Did lots of writing, lots of self-reflection, and that whole four-year process in and out of that was a very deep spiritual journey for me. So that was really the first step in me starting to change my life. And as far as specifically related to activism and to journalism and to exposing a lot of the crimes that we see in the world and to trying to dedicate my time to solutions, that didn't start till about a year and a half after I got out. After I got out of prison for the final time, I was a felon now, so I was looking for jobs. I would go to the library every single day and apply for jobs, and I had to learn what it's like to live with this X on my back. As you guys are aware, our society deems individuals who've been in this situation, you know, rejected from society, or you're supposed to, you know, treat felons differently, or you can't necessarily hire them for certain jobs. And I was starting to get acclimated to this new environment and this new understanding. And at the same time, after all of my experience locked up behind bars, it felt like a cloud had been lifted. And after years and years of just being in a miserable place and very unhappy and not quite sure how to deal with it, and also not having much of a sense of self-esteem or self-empowerment, I went from that to really starting to be optimistic, to understanding that I had value and that I could, you know, that I was an intelligent person and that I could, you know, I could do something with my life. So when that process began, I started to just check out books from that library that I was going to every day. I started to read about the drug war, which is really fresh on my mind because I had just gotten out of being locked up for drugs. And from there, just the drug war was really the first crack in the facade, I guess, of a lot of things we see. And it went from the drug war to looking into government and politics itself, and then starting to pay attention and starting to look at the crimes of government. And in early 2010, I started an activist group called the Houston Freethinkers that continues to this day and has been involved with a lot of different forms of activism in the city. And you mentioned the conscious resistance. A couple of years after that, I feel like I had a second shift, a deeper shift that helped me recognize that for me personally, the journey, the struggle, the fight for freedom in the physical world is only one aspect of that larger fight. There's also a deeper fight that exists within each of us personally. You know, you could say on a spiritual level, on a on a consciousness level. And to me, they go hand in hand. And that's essentially the message of the Conscious Resistance. The Conscious Resistance is also the title of a series of books that I've written in the past couple years that I'm working on with a good friend of mine. So, you know, it's been six years now of just doing radio podcasts, and I have a radio show in Houston now, and I live in the Freethinker house, and we can get into that more later. And I basically just dedicate as much time as I can to writing, and now it's become also my job, my income. I write for Activist Post and Anti-Media and a couple other outlets that I'm paid for. So that allows me to spend time researching these topics, writing about them, sharing that information, doing videos and podcasts and whatever I can to spread awareness, and then also using that knowledge to focus on creating solutions like Freedom Cells and the things that I try to spread through my book. So it really has become a way of life for me, and just about dedicating as much time as possible towards these causes, because nothing else has felt as rewarding as doing this. Nothing has felt as important and as meaningful than trying to understand how I can better myself and heal myself and encourage that same thing in other people so that we can create a truly empowered world.
Wow. Thank you for sharing all that, Derek. You know, a good portion of our audience shares some of the same struggles you have. We have a lot of listeners who are, you know, survivors of government mind control projects and various things like that, who deal with the same kind of struggles that you're speaking of. And so I know they really appreciate you sharing so much of yourself like that. And, you know, so as I was telling you before, when we were talking before the show, we tend to focus a lot on mind control, and I can't think of a bigger mind control that everybody is under than this idea that we have to have government, that things would just be chaotic and insane without it, when clearly they're chaotic and insane with it. So, you know, so from that sort of aspect, I'm assuming, since you've done your research, you talked about knowing a lot about the drug war, that's actually how I kind of broke my knowledge into this stuff as well. I took a class in college that the teacher was talking about Gary Webb and the Dark Alliance and MKUltra, and that sort of broke me into this, and my political awareness was kind of raising at the same time. So I'm going to assume that you are well versed in those topics. So from that aspect of mind control, I mean, would you agree that look at this election, look at the way people, I have conversations with my dad where he insists that having criminals rule us is better than having no one rule us at all. You know, he's a smart guy. It doesn't make any sense. What is going on here?
Yeah, I do agree that breaking the propaganda, the statist propaganda, and also I think more just generally the authoritarian propaganda, this sort of false belief in undue authority, and the idea that elitists or people with certain credentials are the people who should be most capable of ruling our lives and leading our lives for us and making our decisions for us, is something that is really bred into us and beat into us from a very young age. And of course, if you go to state educated systems, that's 12 years of, you know, getting you to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, for the national anthem, for all these different things. I actually did a video the other day called, it was more about voting, but it was also about the state itself and, you know, the United States as a statist institution, and just discussing how voting is a ritual, and it's a ritual of the cult of America, and all cults have certain sacraments and certain things that are unquestionable, or, you know, that everybody must do in order to be a part of the club. And America has these as well, with the national anthem and with the Pledge of Allegiance and all these different things. When you really step back and you think, like, wow, we're sending little kids to these education centers where they have them repeating a dogma and repeating an oath to pledge allegiance to a flag and to a concept that they can't even really understand yet. And it's never really truly explained. These are what the words you're saying mean. These are what you are actually saying to do, that you will pledge allegiance to this nation regardless of, you know, whatever it has done, which ultimately is more of, it's nationalism. It's not patriotism. I definitely think that there's a distinction to be made there. Whether patriotism has value or not itself is another discussion, but it's jingoistic nationalism that gets pushed into each of us, and it all comes back down to, in my view, disempowering the people in order to empower the state. So what I mean to say by that is that they would like these various institutions, the various mechanisms that work together with the state, corporate power, state power, media institutions, all the various organizations that work together. What they would like to see is an individual, a community, a race, a humanity that is disempowered, disenfranchised, and deceived into believing that they cannot rule themselves, that they're incapable of making their own decisions, and that without this certain class, you know, the elite class, the healthy people, the parasite class, that we would just, you know, kill each other, that we're just waiting, we're all just murderers waiting to just, you know, go crazy on each other. The only thing holding us back is the U.S. government or the existence of government.
Yeah.
We'd all just be mobsters.
Right.
We'd forget about our morals and just be horrible people, which we all know to be false because there's countless examples of this concept of decentralized community aid and community building and empowered individuals, not in the sense of a kind of vulgar, you know, misrepresentation of individuality in the sense of full of ego and not thinking about the future, not that sort of individuality,
right,
but a sense of individuality that recognizes I am a beautiful, free, powerful human being, and so are all these other beings around me. And it's in my best interest as a free individual to work with other free individuals, to cultivate that and to empower myself to work on my doubts, insecurities, my fears, and to do the healing that is necessary so that I can become the best me that I can be. And at the same time, encourage that in other people, lead by example, show them how an empowered being can live and can look and act. And we'll see, and it's all, I mean, I already see this happen.
Yeah.
So many beautiful things that happen once you start to really commit your life to trying to change yourself as much as you're trying to change.
Yeah.
And also focusing on solutions and actually taking action, because it can be very daunting to be in this world surrounded by this sort of status paradigm of people who believe that we're incapable of ruling ourselves. If you're only focused on those negative issues,
yeah,
or if you're not taking any steps in your life, like if you're not taking any steps to make yourself more free and your life more rewarding, or to cultivate internal healing and self-reflection, then yeah, life is going to seem pretty stressful and pretty chaotic. Yeah. And especially if you're focused on what they want you to focus on, you know,
yeah, which is
the latest, you know, scandal from this politician or that politician, or that celebrity. You know, it's all low brow, low frequency things that are not meant to promote a healthy state of mind. So all those various issues and problems, they feed into that same mentality that you're discussing, this idea of mind control, that the state is essentially promoting a state of mind, you know. And we see this again back in briefly on the elections. We see this with the recent release of plenty of documents through WikiLeaks that essentially show what most of us have known, but how staged the media truly is and how scripted everything is.
Yeah.
To the presidential election. It's not just the presidential election. It's all kinds of events. So then when you really recognize that, wow, so a lot of the events that are happening in my world and around us are being pushed a certain way, or they're being reported in a certain way to serve somebody else's agenda. So then when people start to form opinions and ideas and relationships and prejudices based on this misinformation and disinformation that's coming from the state, then they are now walking around carrying a misinformed opinion, a misinformed view of the world around them, which keeps them in a state of imbalance. So it all feeds into itself.
And
again, the answer to that is to disengage, but not only from their propaganda, their mental psychological propaganda, but to disengage from the educational propaganda that has for so long said that human beings cannot work together. I'd like to just throw two examples to listeners who are skeptical of the possibility of humans working together in a decentralized manner without, you know, without the government. The first example is the Common Ground Collective that was in New Orleans, Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina in 2005. This was a collective of just activists, anarchists, community members, all kinds of people from really around the country. A lot of them came from Austin, Texas, not far from where I'm at, and some from Houston as well. And when Hurricane Katrina came and wiped out New Orleans, and there were certain neighborhoods that FEMA wouldn't even go into, and that the Red Cross and the government was saying, DHS was saying they couldn't go help certain people or it was unsafe, the volunteers, the activists with the Common Ground Collective, they organized and all headed to New Orleans, groups of people. They set up nursing stations. They set up feeding stations. They went to certain neighborhoods to go check on people in parts where the cops and the local authorities wouldn't go, to go help rescue people. They witnessed the U.S. government out there, the military out there after Katrina, going door to door and taking people's weapons. I mean, they really were able to be out there not only to document but to support as a mutual aid group, and they did so in the absence and failure of the state that refused to provide assistance. And you have a similar example taking place a couple years ago, and with the Hurricane Sandy in New York. There was Occupy Sandy, was another group that was formed. It was a similar situation. The government was failing to do their job, or for whatever reason, bureaucratic, you know, BS probably, did not provide the help needed for the people. So ultimately, Occupy Sandy organized voluntarily, decentralized, without taking taxes or stolen money from anybody else, and just doing it for the community and for themselves, and were able to help tons of people. So those are just two small, simple examples, and yes, they're minute examples, but if you really doubt the ingenuity of humanity, then I don't know. I think that we need to take a deeper look at ourselves, and again, it starts with self-love, because once you recognize how powerful you are, then you really do see that we're capable of doing so much, and it's only that we've been fed propaganda and held down in a number of ways, and basically all forms of mind control, however you look at it.
Yeah.
Propaganda from the media or not, it's all elements of mind control. I like to tell people that we're going to be programmed one way or the other. It can be from your own internal programming and learning to be as conscious of your own mind and your own doubts and insecurities and fears and the influences that all these other external forces have on you. So whatever you're watching on news or movies and all these things or propaganda that you're being fed by the government, there's all these different sources fighting and vying for your attention, for your thoughts and how to direct that attention. So the stronger we are mentally, internally, spiritually, physically, the better chance we have to stay in control of our mind, to free our minds ourselves, and to, at the least, when we choose to take in this propaganda or whatever external information we take in, we can do so with the knowledge that we have a strong mind that is capable of handling that.
Yeah.
And is not going to be overwhelmed or, you know, deceived, because we've seen in this election season that plenty of people who felt like or seemed to be kind of aware or awake, however you want to put it, the world seem to be falling for the same old thing once more. And it's, I think, because maybe they haven't quite gotten past that mind control stage.
Yeah.
So the state does a great job, and they have hundreds of years of practice on how to propagandize the people. So we're kind of playing catch up here.
Yeah. So you hit on some great points there. Government is just like religion. I love when Larkin Rose says that the government is the most dangerous superstition, the most dangerous religion. Same kind of mind control. You hit on like a bunch of good points there. One of the things me and Randy talk about often in our private conversations is that there isn't the problems that we have now. Not only is there's not a governmental solution to it. There's not a financial solution to it in the way that people think of that. It's not like, oh, well, if we just didn't have debt or whatever, then it wouldn't, you know, it's not a governmental solution, not a financial solution. The only solution there is a mindfulness, awareness, and behavioral change solution. And I think that's what you're speaking of. And then the last point you hit on there, which was really good, and I wanted to get into next, I'm going to see if Randy has something to say first, but I just wanted to say is, yes, particularly people who had gotten off the Republican and Democrat reservations and were sort of on the smaller reservations of the Libertarian and the Green Party seem to have fallen for this trick again. You know, lots of people, the alternative media, whose work has been good, you know, for a long time, like people like Stefan Molyneux, Cantwell, they're all in on this Trump thing. And then, you know, we also see this weird division amongst people who were at least in that, you know, whether you're on the progressive or the conservative side, we're either in the libertarianish, greenish section, or even moving towards possible anarchy, being divided into this like alt-right or Black Lives Matter kind of, like, you know, like the divide and conquer. Those are the two most extreme situations that we see going on right now. So I want to see if Randy has something to say, but then I would like to hear what you have to say about that. Randy, did you want to say something?
Well, there's a whole realm of things that we could go into. Just from your background, obviously, you know, going through drug addiction, going through the court system, going through the prison system, I'm sure you gained an insight and an understanding into how you as an individual person, an individual soul, were merchandised through that system and how they used the mechanics of what is essentially a victimless crime. I assume you did not assault anybody in an armed robbery or kill anybody or take anybody's property per se. we're dealing strictly here with, quote, drug enforcement. How interesting that most of the flow of drug traffic into the country is coming from Central Intelligence Agency and Langley in the first place. And they've used these drugs to bankroll all of their military operations and their intelligence operations, covert operations, black ops, call it what you want. So in effect, you as a person coming into the system already traumatized by your life and by your drug addiction, now have to deal with the fact that you are a statistic, a number on a court docket, and then brought into a federal system, a federal prison system, whether it's federal or state, it doesn't matter, it works the same. But the concept here is that you somehow owe something to, quote, society for a crime that you committed against society. Did that kind of like, was that kind of like a radicalizing point for you?
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you brought that. It definitely is a good point. Basically, for me, that awareness, the realization that I was locked up for victimless crime, it didn't come for several years later, you know, when I started to understand the message of anarchism and of liberty and of victimless crimes itself, that whole concept. But I do want to say that is a very important point, because when I talk about this story and I talk about the life changes that I made and, you know, what happened to me as a result of leaving the prison system, I do like to emphasize that it didn't, the changes and the person that I've become had nothing to do with prison. The place did not change me for the better. It's a horrible institution that, you know, I saw all kinds of disturbing things, and I had plenty of people that I know who are still cycling in and out of that system. Other people got it the first time, you know, others just, you know, they just, that's just how they are. They just stay in that system, and I was able to get out of it. So it's a demoralizing, dehumanizing place, both to the guards, to the people that are there. I mean, it's a disgusting institution. So it has to come down to a personal, individual choice, and that's the choice that I made. And as I said, it wasn't until several years later that not only did I realize, okay, well, you know, I was doing this thing that they consider illegal. I kind of understood, well, they consider it illegal, but that doesn't really matter to me. But I didn't really quite get it until, again, later, and when I recognized I didn't hurt anybody. I know that my choice my decision to use drugs, it wasn't coming from a very stable place. I will say that it was self-medication. So the drug use wasn't really anything positive per se, but I wasn't hurting anybody else other than myself. And instead of having an institution and a system that promotes locking people up for victimless crimes, when more than likely they just need some type of help, you know, physical help, mental health, et cetera. That's the problem, because I just needed some people to talk to. I needed a way to find how to communicate the things and the pain I was going through. And drugs were what I found, and it was easy just to get blitzed out of my mind and not worry about it for another night, you know. But that got me involved with all sorts of drug dealing and just lots of shady people and just a criminal lifestyle that kind of goes along with that. And the reason there's a criminal lifestyle that goes along with those drugs is not because the people using them are bad people. It's because the state prohibits those things and the state criminalizes those things. So then you end up having people who decide, for whatever reason, not my place to judge, but for whatever reason, to use these substances, they're now forced to kind of go into these criminal markets or to hang out with other seedy people who maybe are truly criminals who are willing to do property damage or violence against other people. But then you get nonviolent victims, you know, people who are not committing any sort of crime, who just want to ingest substances for whatever reason. And those two crowds mix. And that's what brings the danger and the violence to the drugs, if anything. You know, like you said, obviously the CIA and other government institutions fully support drugs. It's just that they do it in their own way. Publicly, they condemn drugs. But ultimately, it's about controlling the people and demonizing the people. And the same thing with the drug war, the failed drug war. They're not after actually healing people like me or people who are in my situation. They're after control. They're after making money. They're after having mass incarceration. And being able to just, you know, continue that billion-dollar racket, and really what it comes down to.
Cool.
All right. So let's pick back. Thanks for that. I agree with you completely. I actually even remember watching a video that you made maybe like 9 months or a year back, where you had this realization that you were actually participating in the black or the gray market when you were selling drugs, and if there wasn't this whole other see the criminal side to it, it was in some ways actually a revolutionary act. You're setting
The only material difference between the street drug dealer in Pfizer is that Pfizer is a multinational corporation with a huge budget, and they operate through the FDA, which regulates them, controls them, and makes money off of the drugs that they sell in the, quote, legal market. Drugs that are as lethal, if not more lethal, than the drugs that are on the street, by the way. So here again, now we have government-sanctioned pharmaceutical poisoning of the populace, or the doping of the public, you know, which goes into the whole cycle we have right now with the election syndrome, as you and I talked about, Emily. You know, in my view right now, this election is a lot like the World Wrestling Federation. You know, these are very colorful characters that they've given us. You know, no one's a villain, no one's a hero, but somewhere in there, there's either the fear of Trump or the loathing of Hillary, and that's how you're going to make your choices. So, you know, you buy your popcorn and you sit down and you duke it out until, I guess, you know, the crowds head off to the ballot box and theoretically cast a ballot. Whether that even matters at this point seems to me nebulous.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That is something that Randy and I have talked a lot about, how even within this election cycle, people aren't even voting for someone they want to vote. They're voting strictly from a fear-based place, fear of Trump or fear of Clinton. You know, like I know in my family, I come from a family of mostly liberal people, and none of them, they're all people with high morals, you know, who I love and who have nothing in common with Hillary Clinton and who don't hold the same values of her that she does. But they're so fearful of Trump, and you know, and they, you know, that they're willing to sign on with somebody who is absolutely disgusting, amoral, criminal psychopath. You know, they both are. There's no difference. I try and tell people that, like, it doesn't matter who you vote for, the same thing's going to happen, just the way it's spoken about will be different. That's it, you know?
I agree.
Yeah, and so let's, you know, what do you think has happened? Just we'll get into this a little bit, and then I want to kind of turn around and start focusing on the philosophy of voluntarism and whatnot. But what do you think is going on with these people who have fallen for this divisive rhetoric? Some people who have really been helpful to us and are in the alternative media and educating us, and I'm sure people who you've learned a lot from suddenly falling back into this. And I think it's, like I said, most exemplified in this sort of alt-right and the Black Lives Matter thing. And what do you think is going on? Like, why do you think this is happening? Do you think they were always, that was who they always were, or this is fear for them, or what do you think is going on?
Well, it's a great question. I think it's probably a combination of things. I have my theories and speculation that I can offer. And it ranges from whether or not individuals are COINTELPRO agents, because it would be silly to assume that any movement that exists, independent media, truth movements, liberty, anarchist movements, etc., that those movements haven't been infiltrated in any way, and that none of the people who are kind of major players or, you know, influential people, that none of them would be involved with the government. Based on all the, you know, historical evidence of the program in the past, it would be just stupid to not assume that that's not happening today. So with that in mind, I kind of always keep that, in the back of my mind. Wow, is this a possibility? Other times, people just, maybe they never really got the message, but then, you know, you mentioned like Molyneux, and obviously Molyneux did a great job in the past of bringing so many people to a deeper level of thinking. I don't think he's a perfect thinker, obviously, anymore, but I never really did in the first place. But he's definitely a powerful person. I interviewed him a couple times, 2012 and 2013. And the person that I interviewed back then is a completely different person that exists today, who is out there telling people to vote for Donald Trump.
That is very interesting that you would say that, because that's something we've noticed a lot, is that it almost seems like people become different people over time in the alternative media.
Yeah, no, I would agree. And again, it's difficult. And, you know, I don't mind talking about it, you know, because we should acknowledge these things, because that's also how the listening public and other activists recognize who they can trust. Because ultimately,
that's part of community right there. We have to be self-policing.
Yeah, you know, when we get past this election, what are the people who've been supporting Trump going to look like? Or, you know, either one, like you were saying, Emily, they're the same regardless. But to me, it's like, you look like a fool now. You just spent the last however many months trying to convince people to doing this after telling, you know, we could say Alex Jones, we could say Molyneux, others who have said for years that the left-right paradigm is, you know, it's the same, blah, blah, look past it. You know, there's no hope in government, saying all these things. Now backpedaling, where you have these people saying, oh, I never said that, or totally just rewriting their histories, or just going extremely hard in one direction. Now, the why of this situation, I think I definitely have some insight into that, because it's something I've been following for quite some time, and especially because when you get, I mean, you get into these movements away from the mainstream, what I refer to as the dead stream.
Yeah, no stream.
And, you know, the dead stream world where there's this following of celebrity media, following of like whatever Hollywood's talking about, following of the corporate news, et cetera, et cetera. When you get away from that and you get away from the politics, you're like, oh, wow, I found other awake, aware, enlightened people. And they all, you know, understand freedom, and it looks like we're going to do something powerful. And then you realize, oh, no, there's as much infighting and bickering and division in these movements than there are in everywhere else I've been.
Maybe and worse.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe even worse. It's like we find other people who are kind of close on the same, you know, area where we have common ground, but we're going to fight even more than we do fight with people who are actually making decisions that hurt us and harm us. So we have that situation. And I know for me, that was personally a bit disappointing. And I think for others, it is as well. So there may be some level of division that is always going to exist, but on a deeper level, specifically to the alt-right. And I think, you know, you said the opposite side, you referenced Black Lives Matter. I definitely can see how some people feel that way. I think that what I've seen more than BLM, and this could be kind of in the same category, is you have the so-called regressive left social justice warrior culture, like super PC culture. The alt-right and the social justice warrior left culture, they may bring up certain issues that we can say, oh, wow, there's, you know, there's something to that.
They have a point, yeah.
It's the way that they bring them up, though, and it's the approach. Now, what I've seen, basically, is over the years of, you know, Obama being here and doing all his crimes, you've had this growing anti-Obama sentiment, and some of that element, for sure, definitely seems to have racist undertones, you know, because maybe there are just people who, they know what's going on.
Yeah.
The government, we might call them allies on some issue, but ultimately they're being driven by maybe their bigotry or their prejudice or something like that.
Yeah.
And in that, you have Obama just continuing to do what he does, and more people getting upset.
Yep.
And you have somebody like Donald Trump stepping in and stoking those fires
yep.
and those flames and promoting this, like, hey, we could do something about this. So the right, the alt-right, is just, they're pushing very extreme, right? The message is, we're sick of the left trying to be politically correct. We're sick of the left trying to break up the, you know, the traditional family values and this and that.
Yeah.
And we're sick of Obama. We're sick of the liberal this and that. So in an attempt to get away from that, or what seems more like dominate that, these people who pretended or seemed to believe in liberty and freedom and volunteerism,
now they're white nationalists.
Yeah, now it's all of a sudden this strong man came along, and their response is to go even more extreme. So that's what I'm seeing, is that the system itself and the state is just like they do. I mean, this is just age-old division when you really get down to it.
Yep.
But they're just
divide and conquer.
And the election, and the election is, it's such an important time to be, again, self-aware, because the elections are such an easy time to divide people. They do it every 4 years, and it gets more often because they really start covering the elections like 2 years out now.
This one has done this thing where it not only has created division in society, it's created a division in people's own minds.
No, right? Absolutely. And I think that this is the problem is that these extreme polarities are being exploited, those divisions, whether it's over race or, you know, various identity movements, identity politics, people are basically being pulled apart. So the left is like, we're sick of the right wing and their bigotry and their hate. And, you know, of course, they're generalizing and collectivizing a whole group of people without knowing individually. And both sides are doing it. That's the ironic thing.
Like, exactly the same thing, but in reverse. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The alt-right says like, oh, we're sick of how all these people are doing that. So instead of, you know, trying to preach to stay principled and to actually stay with the principles and ideals of true freedom, they just want to get a strong man to suppress their enemies. They're like, well, I need to suppress them before they suppress me. So both sides are going more extreme, and the system is happy to exploit that, to push this agenda of, okay, well, on this side, you got the social justice warrior, Black Lives Matter, various identity movements. Over here, you've got this like real hardcore going right, traditional values, Western civilization type of talk.
Yeah.
It's just, it's this dichotomy that is really being pulling people apart. And unfortunately, that point apart is taking certain people that I think some of us maybe have lost friends over this, and people that we really felt like were principled or like understood what was going on. And now you come to find out, wait, I guess you never really got the message, or because how I don't really understand how you get the message of freedom
and then unget it. Yeah, that is it's one of those things that I think it is. I think these people were never free in their own minds, and that's why I think that they spoke. I think for them, I think the only way people are able to progress is if freedom is an external thing for them. Like if the government sets us free, then we'll be free, rather than it's our job to become free in our own minds, and that will break the chains for the whole thing. So I think maybe that's how that happens. But your points are all very good, and I can completely agree with just about everything you just said. But I think it's also, this thing has created the perfect scenario for if there is some kind of governmental or economic collapse, they can make it about a race war, right? And so then nobody will look at what the real problem, again, not stay looking at what the actual problems are, and it can be seen, the whole problem is that we have racists, and we have poor people, and we have this and that, you know what I mean? And we'll let them fight, and nobody will pay attention to the people who have been dominating and ruling over us, and they've actually created this situation and exploited the bifurcation in people's own minds.
Race war, gender wars, economic wars.
Yeah.
The big illusion here is that there's something out there called a federal government with CEOs sitting at the top of it that has the ability to solve these massive problems, when the real thinking goes into realizing that it was that system, that structure, that created all of these problems on the scale that they exist. Because what we're really talking about, and if I understand, Derek, what you are doing with your movement, this is about scale. This is about bringing things back down to human scale again. There's no reason why we need to sit here and talk about the election of a CEO of a government services corporation, which has nothing to do with the constitutional government that we theoretically consented to, and that's another issue in this as well, the issue of consent. Because what we are doing as a populace with this run to the polls every 4 years with the presidential election, because quite honestly, this is the big one. Nobody gives a shit about who's running for dog catcher or city council or school board, all the local level. You know, it was Bill Clinton who so facetiously said back in the 90s, all politics are local. He didn't believe that, but he actually conceived that that was a concept that you could drive into people's consciousness. He was right. It is all local. And it's more local than most people can conceive of, because basically we want the empire to continue handing us solutions when in fact what they're doing is creating problems and then giving us problem, reaction solution.
Absolutely. Yeah. They're definitely the driving this, the same opposition, the same force that people are trying to expose is the same force that is exploiting their issues and their fears to create division. And it's unfortunate to see it happen to people who are in the activist milieu. But also, I think this, to me, I see this more, I try to look at it from a hopeful standpoint and an optimistic standpoint that, hey, at least now I'm getting to see who I can trust, who I can really count on.
Yeah.
And the people who maybe weren't either there just yet, and maybe they'll come back around later and be like, oh my God, guys, I fell for it again. They got me. I fell for it. Maybe we can hope for that, or, you know, maybe they're just lost to the cause now. I'm not sure.
And then at least we know it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We know the truth where people stand, and that's what we need to know. We need to know who's going to not stand for freedom, who's not going to stand for the people, and not just other activists, but if you look at the various people, like for example, we can take Bernie Sanders and the people who had faith and hope in him, and now him going around and campaigning for Clinton and really just following that party line, whether it's because he got scared or got paid, it doesn't really matter. He's pushing that narrative that he spent the last year supposedly pushing against. So I'm happy to know who is, you know, where these people stand. I'm happy that they're revealing themselves and exposing themselves for these things, whether their name's Molyneux, Jones, or just some other activists I know. I'll still speak to them and try to reach people and hope that they can, you know, come back from that. But I also, my suspicions of COINTELPRO will probably grow as those larger figureheads and people who have large audiences if they continue to push in this direction, because I really don't think that someone could be as intelligent as some of these people, as we know some of these people are, and then just make this total, you know, 180 turn towards basically fascism.
Yeah, I mean, the thing, and I've mentioned this before, like just the complete example of that is, how is it that the person who warned us of the police state now is endorsing somebody who believes in an enormous police state?
Yeah,
exactly. How does that happen? You know what I mean? Like that, like there's something else going on there. So, okay. So we've kind of broken down this paradigm a little bit here. And so let's move into, you know, obviously what we're getting at here is the solution to these problems is not different government. People always ask me, say to me, don't complain about the government if you don't vote. I'm like, well, there's no point in me voting. I don't want a different government. I want no government. It's like writing letters to Santa Claus after you don't believe in him anymore. It doesn't make much sense. So, so we're proposing the solution being anarchy, or I prefer when I'm speaking to people who don't understand the concept and the philosophy to use the term voluntarism, mostly because people don't have a preconceived idea of what that is, so it gives me a chance to explain it to them, whereas when you say anarchy, they think, you know, people running around on the street with Molotov cocktails and stuff like that. So why don't you explain to, for the listeners, what, how you, your view on this, and what is voluntarism or anarchy to you?
So for me, I actually think that if you really look at the definition and understanding of anarchism as a philosophy, as a historical philosophy, that the terms voluntarism ultimately are interchangeable. Yeah. But I do agree with you in the sense that the average person has been so propagandized that every Hollywood movie out there replaces chaos with anarchy. And they do that probably by design. But
of course,
we also have to blame for that certain anarchists that were more of the insurrectionary anarchist schools, and you know, in
it's kind of the punk rock definition of anarchy.
Yeah, so I mean, there's definitely, like, we understand the where that can come from, which is why it's so important. You know, some would say it's important to try to retake that word and to explain it, to have these type of conversations. Others would say the words ultimately don't matter if the people get the concept. So, what is the concept? The concept being specifically with voluntarism, that we can create a society that is voluntary, that is removes force and coercion from all human interaction. And when you really start, most people, they hear that, they're like, yeah, I don't really want to use force or coercion in my interactions with other people. So I guess I'm fine with that. And then when you take that and you extrapolate the idea and you take it a bit deeper, you start to question the institution of government itself and the role that government plays. You have to acknowledge that government, the relationship, if we can call it that, between the people and the government is one that is totally built on force and coercion and theft and threat and violence.
Yep.
That relationship is not consensual. That, it, for example, if the people of America today were given the opportunity to sign the Declaration of Independence again today, and or the Constitution, say, and stand by this government and reaffirm those rights, I don't think we would have very much support for that idea, you know. And so if you can't sit there and say that the people have consensually, voluntarily come to you to offer you their tax money in order to do the job you're doing, then you can't very well say that their consent is actually been given. It's been assumed, or it's been taken maybe by some guys 200 years ago, but that doesn't really reflect on the decisions that you or I make. And I don't really think I should be held or bound by those decisions.
Yep.
So when you really look at it, then you're like, okay, well, if government is force, if government is coercion, and if I'm trying to create a world that's more ethical, that's more free, that's more prosperous, and where violence is systemic and you know, systematic violence are not accepted on the level that we see them today. Like you said earlier, the world isn't really in a perfect state anyways. You know, some people are sitting fat and happy, and they still got food in their fridge and hundreds of channels on TV and AC in their house, so they think the world's perfect. But a lot is changing, and we have to come to a place where we're going to decide what kind of future we want, you know. And if you want to do that, if you want to create a world that is going to be one that your future children or families or friends want to live in, the future generations want to live in, then we have to start rethinking the decisions that we make, rethinking what we've been taught about government, the role that government's supposed to play in our lives, and whether or not government institutions are really capable of making choices for us as free people. And if there aren't alternatives to that, you know, because the idea isn't just to say, well, the government is bad, it's force, it's theft, it's coercion, so we should eliminate it now and just let, you know, a vacuum be there, or let whatever happens happen. I do think spontaneous order will happen. The examples I gave earlier are just two examples of how people come together when they're faced with no other option. We can choose to be proactive rather than reactive. We can recognize that the system that exists, the United States government and the institutions that partner with them, are unsustainable, and that they are on a death march toward a collapsed empire. And we can choose to say, rather than standing here and just, you know, delaying that as long as possible and just enjoying my life where it is now and not worrying about the future, rather than doing that and, you know, waiting for the shit to hit the fan so that FEMA can show up in your town and say, come on down to the town square, come downtown, we got beds and food for your family, we're going to take care of you guys, don't worry. Or you can go down the block and you can go loot and riot at the grocery store and try to see if you can survive that while everybody else who didn't plan is trying to survive. Or another option is you can be the ones who were already thinking ahead and who are spreading the message of voluntarism, the message of anarchism, of self-governance, of self-rule, of removing these false authorities. And not only that, but taking proactive steps to become more self-reliant, more independent, more autonomous, and sustainable. So that's the choice that I think we ultimately have to make, is in looking into voluntarist ideas, looking into our relationships with other people, and deciding what kind of world we want, one that is built on force or one that is built on voluntary choice, mutual aid, cooperation, and an individual liberation achieved through collective action.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that those are all excellent points. One of the things that I think with people, misconceptions people have about anarchy or voluntarism is that it means no rules, and it doesn't. It means no rulers, right? And so this idea of no rulers but still having rules, I think one of the things it's going to take from people is a radical self-responsibility, like a radical looking at yourself, taking personal inventory. And if everybody, you know, it doesn't seem that far of a leap. If everybody, you know, just behave, you know, if there was all of a sudden no government tomorrow, I would do the same thing I'm doing today, because I take moral inventory of myself and I make sure that all the behaviors that I do are behaviors that are in line with what I think is right and where I'm trying to go with things. And I think if people did that, then it wouldn't seem like such a far leap. But because people have been lulled into this idea of, I just have to do the thing to take care of myself, and someone else makes all these other decisions, they're ultimately not taking responsibility for the things that are happening in their name. So I think that's, you know, I think that part of the reason people reject this idea is most people are really afraid to become completely responsible for all of the decisions they make and all of the actions they take. The other thing that I like about voluntarism or anarchy is that it allows for, if people want to organize into groups or mini or communities or mini states or whatever they want to do and govern themselves the way they want to, it allows for that as long as it's, you're not forcing other people who don't want to. Whereas in this system we're now, everybody has to do, everybody is swept into it, whether they want to be or not. You know, I think one of the things that would happen, I think, you know, people in my family who are more leftist and progressive think that, like, oh, if there's no government, then nobody will help each other. I'm like, well, that's not true. I help people now and I'd still help people then. But just because there'd be no government enforcing it doesn't mean that people can't organize and do that on their own if they want to. You know what I mean? If that's how they want to live. What do you think about that? I think if there wasn't things forced on people, lots of people would organize and do what I call almost, you know, voluntary socialism. Like, there are some decent ideals to socialism. The problem is when you have an overlord deciding what that would be. So what do you think about that idea?
I do think in a truly free voluntary society that you would have actual, you know, the word, the label and the phrase has so much negative connotation to it, and it's a lot to unpack. But I think in that situation, you would have the closest thing to what many people consider to be a free or freed market, an actual open exchange of ideas. Some of those might be communes where everybody decides they're going to be moneyless and they're only going to do gift exchanges. But that only applies to the community they live in. And you know that you come to that community, you participate, you play by the rules, and that's fine. And everybody's free to leave or as they please. But then maybe there's another that is a group of individuals living together in a neighborhood built around their principles. You would have all these things happen in a truly anarchist space or milieu. Because that's what voluntarism is about, is allowing that experimentation. And ultimately, that's how we find out what ideas will work and which will fail, by by experimenting and by putting them, you know, together. We can write books all day, we can theorize on the internet and talk about it, but until we get to the point where the state is greatly reduced or completely gone, ultimately we don't know what people are going to do. I have trouble believing that human beings are just going to stand there and sit by and do nothing as, you know, the world around them, you know, goes downhill. For example, this is just a minor example, but I think we would see a lot of these things happen here in Houston. The city of Houston has several million dollars in debt. And of course, they try to make it seem as that's like the people's debt or something like that. Right. But I had nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
But they have this huge debt. And so, as is typical, the state starts to cut services that apply and help people first. That's, you know, what we see in the Euro crisis in places like Greece and others. They start cutting health services and support services for the people. Ultimately, the last institutions in a collapsing state are usually, that are actually still getting paid, are the police and the military, because they need them to maintain power and control. But in Houston, they cut the recycling service for a while. So they basically said, we're no longer going to do recycling collection. You have to, if you want to recycle, you got to, you know, go through it yourself and go find a station to deliver it to, because we just can't afford to do it right now. We couldn't re-sign the contract. So when that happened, about a week or so later, a 14-year-old kid was covered on the local news for basically just stepping in there, being an entrepreneur, and a smart one at that, a young, intelligent one. And saying, okay, well, since the local government's not going to collect your recycling, me and my dad, or, you know, him and a friend or two, are going to just come around and we'll offer our services. And the story went viral. This kid, I mean, I'm sure they made an immense amount of money, not only because people like the idea of a young man, a young child starting a business, but they recognized, okay, well, the government can't do it. This private individual will, and he's probably going to do a better job of it at that. So people will find ways to take care of each other. You know, we can either let the world go to shit and just, you know, stand by and do nothing. Or, as I said earlier, we can choose to be proactive and start taking steps now that are going to allow us to have that freedom to continue to prosper and to build a better world. But again, it has to start with taking action in our lives and not standing still and waiting for the government, not assuming or believing that violence is the answer, and not believing that voting any person around is going to achieve monumental change. The method and the things that I'm speaking about, I don't necessarily think that they can take place tomorrow, specifically because I do believe that a conscious evolution is a part of this in order for the principles of voluntarism and anarchism to be put into action. But it's something that will lead to true lasting change, and generational change, as opposed to just every 4 years believing that you're doing your duty and registering a vote and going and pressing a button or signing a name on a piece of paper. The change I'm talking about, it requires, as you were saying, which is a huge point, personal responsibility. People have to take responsibility for their actions. They need to get up off their asses and decide, okay, do I want to live in a free world? Do I want to live in a world where the environment is not completely poisoned? Do I want to have a future for myself? And do I want other people who I can't even imagine the circumstances they're coming into, do I want them to have a chance?
Yeah.
So I should probably think about that in these moments and take actions to create that reality. And that's what it's really about. So when I explain this to people, they want to believe that there can be some just quick fix.
No quick fix.
You got to let go of that idea. Things have been screwed up for too long.
Yeah.
No president, no puppet, you know, none of these things are going to fix everything. It's going to take a lot more change than that. I think that's difficult for people to accept.
Well, one of the things that I've done over the years as an exercise, as kind of a thought game, is to invite people to imagine life without big government anymore. I preface it by saying big government, because clearly on some level we need to organize, we need to have the functions of our society. The trash has to be collected, the water has to be run. These are all functions that are basically free market exercises at their best that have been co-opted by the government. Mm-hmm. But reframe for a minute and consider what happens when you eliminate the layers of government that are authoritarian. We'll start with the police, because most people struggle with that because they think the police are defending them. when in fact, when you look at the activities of these departments, they are not defending you. They are not protecting you. That serve and protect motto on the side of that car relates to their corporate bosses. They're a security force for another government entity. And most people who get pulled over at the side of the road for speeding tickets or other miscellaneous trivial charges, they resent it, but they still don't do the one thing that I've always said, don't bitch to me about a ticket, go to court and fight the damn thing. And most people won't do that. And I don't know where that falls into where you're going, Derek, but my sense of it is that this is a lot like a drug habit. We have to wean people off of this and get them down to a manageable dose before we let them go cold turkey. What do you think?
I do agree that there's probably certain steps that we could take to get there. I mean, I do think that agorism and freedom cells are part of that process, and I know we're going to talk more about that. But I do agree with you that it's important for people to recognize that talking about anarchism, talking about the absence of government or the absence, what we're really talking about is the absence of imposed rulers and leaders.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that there won't be natural leaders and natural people who can have better skills or knowledge, and so they will become an authority on that topic.
Earned authority as opposed to declared authority.
Exactly. And these individuals, we will all be equal individuals rather than some person coming along and declaring themselves some sort of elitist that is deserving of a Secret Service protection that we're all going to pay for. And all the extra ridiculous things that come along with government. Ultimately, I do think it's helpful to let people know that we want to scale back the crimes of government, the authoritarian forms of government, the invasive forms of government, the violent forms of government, which I think ultimately the institution is...
The whole thing.
ultimately I think it's a tool. You know, it's like anything, it's a tool, but maybe it's a tool that it's that ring of power, right? Like, you know, one ring to rule them all, and people think that if they're the ones to wear it, they can do it right this time.
Yeah.
They won't turn into a dictator. They won't turn, you know, they won't make the same decision.
Nope.
So I think ultimately we'll end up there recognizing that the power itself is part of the problem.
Yep.
But it's definitely helpful to get people to see that we can take steps to get there.
All right. On that note, let's go to a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about freedom cells and agorism. Okay. So we're going out. I have a track, Anarchy, by the artist Nassim Lage. We'll see you in a few minutes.
Welcome back to this edition of Off Planet TV. I'm Randy Moggins. With me is Emily Moyer, and we are talking about some fascinating things that have to do with your freedom, what you can do, grassroots. And Derek Brose is here with us, and he's going to talk about his book, his website, and the ideas that he has put together as the framework for voluntarism, or what we would call anarchism on the humane scale. And welcome back to Emily, and welcome back to Derek Brose.
Okay, so you want to go ahead and tell people at your websites, all your projects, where they can reach you, stuff like that, before we get into the second half here?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your audience and to talk with you guys. So my main website that you can follow, a lot of my video reports, my interviews, and essays can be found on theconsciousresistance.com. As far as my journalism, I have a social network for that. It's called Contently. So you can find me at derekbrose.contently.com. I put all my interviews, all my articles there, and they can also be found on Activist Post and theantimedia.org. And as far as some of the topics we're going to get into in a moment, I would also suggest checking out thehoustonfreethinkers.com. And all of these pages are on all the social media stuff. You can find the Conscious Resistance, the Houston Freethinkers on Facebook and Twitter and all that jazz. So wherever you get your information and follow, we'll be there. And we have a YouTube channel as well. So basically, those are my prime sources of work, the Conscious Resistance, and then my journalism on action.
And then you've also written a couple of books, and you have a third one coming. You want to tell people the title of that and about your co-author and whatnot?
Absolutely. I would love to. Thank you. So the books are also titled The Conscious Resistance. It's actually a trilogy. The third book, the final book in the trilogy, will be coming out spring 2017. We haven't set the final date yet, but we didn't even realize, myself and my co-author John Vibes, we did not realize that we were writing a trilogy until we finished the first book. The first book is called The Conscious Resistance: Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality. That came out in April 2015, and the second book just came out this past April. It's called Finding Freedom in an Age of Confusion, and that was also released in April. And basically, the first book, the Reflections on Anarchy and Spirituality, covers the wide range of topics that we've been kind of getting into here, ranging from the history of anarchism, the philosophy itself, the politics of it, and also looking at the history of spirituality, of shamanism, the battle of a free interpretation of the world versus a priestly class interpreting the world.
Yeah.
And official, dogmas and individuals. So we look at that whole range of topics. We also touch on meditation, on psychedelics, on healing. I share more of my personal story. And then in the second half of that first book, we look at the history of anarchist, anti-authoritarian thought and philosophy throughout the history of different world traditions, including anarchism and Christianity, anarchism and Islam, anarchism and Buddhism, and the Tao. Also anarchism and shamanism, and that's where John Vibes and I essentially coined the phrase, saying that anarchism is to the state as spirituality is to religion.
Yeah.
Saying that the religious institutions came along and tried to control and dictate the way that we view the world on the spiritual level, and the same way come along and try to dictate the way that we interpret and view the world from the physical world. So the books are trying to promote that idea that our fight for freedom, fight for understanding and for value in the world, it should lead us and it can lead us to a place of anarchism and voluntarism like we were just discussing, but it can also lead us to a place of self-reflection and of healing, which is where the whole conscious resistance idea comes in. And the second book, Finding Freedom in an Age of Confusion, was specifically written for the individual who is perhaps in their place in their journey and their awakening, where they're dealing with frustration, doubt, fear, anger, alienation from trying to talk to family and friends, and realizing that they are not interested, or they think you're crazy, or whatever it might be. This book is simply, the second book is simply a set of essays that are about empowering, reminding people that they're not alone, also trying to get them to see their own power and to hopefully begin the healing journey. And the second half of that second book also is called Tools for Action, and that's where we dive into some of the spiritual tools that John and I believe can be valuable, including meditation, positive affirmations, creative visualizations, really just a sense of self-reflection, and again, that reprogramming of your own mind, recognizing that you can either create the negative limiting thoughts in your head, or you can choose to push past them and to feed yourself empowering thoughts and empowering ideas that are going to uplift you as opposed to hold you back. So that second book is really about that. It's about trying to lift people up who are in that sort of uncertain, fearful stage.
Yeah.
The third book, the final book, is going to go into everything that we're about to get into. It's going to be more of a hands-on, do-it-yourself, how to create conscious communities. That's, you know, everything we're learning and building right now here in Houston, and what we're learning and working with activists from around the world, all of that information will go directly into this book. So hopefully by the end of that, this trilogy will be something that can open your mind and your heart up from the spiritual standpoint, open you up to the ideas of anarchism, give you some of the tools to empower yourself and to do healing, and then by the end of it, give you some ideas, or at least a strong outline on how to actually create these communities so that we can start creating these pockets of free-minded and open-hearted individuals.
Cool, excellent. Thank you. And when you were just describing particularly the second book, it reminded me of something I wanted to say to you and to our listeners. One of the coolest things about you, I think, is the way you deal with that, like what you were just saying, but a lot of times people are in a phase of being negative, living out of fear, anger, and almost can sometimes become belligerent when talking to people, and that turns people off. And especially, you know, a lot of the examples we have in the media are people like Alex Jones, who, you know, so in some ways makes people who are speaking the truth look crazy. And the style that you've developed for dealing with some of the stuff I really like, and I was trying to explain it to Randy when I was telling him about you and I wanted to bring you on the show, and I love watching your videos when you go to the Houston Police Department meetings and you bug them about the stingrays. And your style for your activism style when you're dealing with protest or dealing with authority, I coin it meditative belligerence. You're being belligerent, but you're doing it in a way that is, you're constantly pulling back into the center of yourself. You're not looking crazy. You're not behaving in a way that can discredit the things you're saying, but you will not stop. You know, you're after a certain thing. So I suggest people find on his YouTube channels, his videos of him getting into heated discussions with the Houston Police Department about their use of stingray devices to pull information off of people's cell phones.
That t-shirt you have on there, does that say don't drone me or don't throne me?
Don't drone me, bro.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, got it. Yeah. I like it. But, you know, I'm sitting there thinking if it says don't throne me, you know, all the rage.
Not either.
Right now, all the rage right now is the HBO series A Game of Thrones, which is this, in my opinion, that book, those series of books and these movies exist to continue the myth of empire, however bloody and sexually explicit and enticing it may seem on the occult side. You know, I was sitting here and I'm thinking, if it says don't throne me, that's interesting, because really what we do is we keep going back to the same old feudal systems again. So anyway, I just kind of went off on a wild tangent there, which I'm known for doing. Sorry about that.
He does it. But yes, everybody check out Derek's meditative belligerence when he talks to the Houston police about stingray devices.
I really like that term, by the way. I'm going to have to, you know, share that. That's a really cool way to put it. I usually refer to it as Jedi mind tricks or something like that, because that's something that one of the questions I've gotten over the years of people like, how do you stay, you know, doing either man on the street interviews or, like you were saying, dealing with cops or the mayor. Houston's last mayor was not very friendly to me because I'd find her in public places and I'd put a camera in her face and ask her real questions, you know, to the point that she was running away from me when she would see me in public. And to me, it's again, like you said, it's just about being focused enough to know that the questions I'm asking matter. People want to know about these topics. So I got to do whatever I can do to get that, whether that means questioning.
Watching you go after authority figures is like watching Tina Turner chant Nam-myoho-renge-kyo. It's like the same kind of, like, I don't know. I like watching you do it. There's something about it that, like, you're getting done what needs to get done, but it isn't creating this, like, internal chaos. for people who are watching it. And it is something that, like, you're not behaving in a way that makes the entire community look crazy. You know what I mean? You're behaving in a way that's like, okay, this guy, like, he's dead serious about what he's doing, and he's going to keep doing it back. You're going to keep going back, keep doing the same thing. But there's almost something like, and actually, and you carry this into all of your work, because you've been really hitting on the same things over and over for years now. You're just finding ever more creative and interesting ways of expressing them and reaching people with them. But you're not, you're just, it's always, talk about it back to the same idea. Talk about it back to the same idea. And I think that's sort of so much what meditation is about, is your mind wanders, bring it back. Your mind wanders, bring it back. And you're absolutely insistent on doing that, and I love it. So I coined that term for you. So take it and do whatever you want with it. We need to make you a T-shirt that says "Meditative Belligerent" or something. Anyway, okay. So let's get into your Houston Freethinker House, Freedom Cells, what they are, and what your hope is with creating this project. What people can learn from it. Go to it.
All right, so thank you for that. I want to say first, everyone, go check out freedomcells.org. And I'll read you briefly just the official definition that me and a couple other guys came up with. Freedom cells are peer-to-peer groups organizing themselves in a decentralized manner with the collective goal of asserting the sovereignty of group members through peaceful resistance and the creation of alternative institutions. So that's a lot to unpack. And basically what we're trying to get at here is, if we're going to solve the problems, we already discussed how voting's not going to do it. Violence isn't going to achieve the goals, not in line really with the world that we're trying to create. So how do we go about then achieving change if we eliminate voting from being a tangible strategy, and if we eliminate violence? What other tools have we left with? You know, we can be apathetic. We can choose to stick our heads in the sand. But wanting to get beyond that and get to a place of actually being able to take action, we are forced to look within. We are forced to look within our own communities and recognize that the strongest place that we can have an effect is going to be locally. So I try to emphasize two things when it comes to locally. First, the most local that you can go is within your own heart and your own mind. So that gets back to, again, the conscious individual healing, the personal change that has to precipitate the larger change that will take place. And that's an ongoing process. It doesn't mean that you one day just all of a sudden you find yourself to be enlightened for the rest of your life. It's an ongoing healing process that we're all taking, you know, steps toward. So that's an important part of Freedom Cells. Mindfulness definitely plays a role in that. But the specific goal comes from Bob Podolsky. He's an author who wrote a book called Flourish, and he actually used to call them Octolog. Some people have called them just simply mutual aid groups. I've been contacted by other people now that we've been putting the idea out there, saying they call them Freedom Hubs or Freedom Centers, just different things. But the core idea is that we're trying to create small groups of people, as many as you can in a local level, but you try to find, ideally, the number is 8, and there's reasons for that, but 7 to 10 is still acceptable, or even if it's just a few of you, it's still acceptable. And you're trying to find people who are, not only are they like-minded and they're aware of the things that you are and they're interested in the things that you are and trying to find solutions, but that these are the people who are ready to take actionable steps in their life and actually do things, actually form compacts and support groups amongst each other. So you take this group of 8, which Bob Podolsky said the reason that him and his team of researchers believe that 8 was the ideal number, is they said, you know, it just seemed to be ideal for coordination, for organization, for teamwork, that once you get past 8 and you go too high, there's a little too many people to be effective. And if you have too little people, you're also a bit ineffective. And they suggested that this group of eight would be split equally, 4 males and 4 females. But we're not so specific with Freedom Cells. We want it to be truly decentralized and allow people to do what best suits their specific needs. So you're forming groups of 8 to 10 people. And the idea being that you can use this structure. The cell thing comes from thinking of like a cellular body. Each individual cell is part of a larger network of cells that form this new body. And we're trying to not work within the old system, but to create...
Assemble the body, yeah.
Exactly. We're putting together a brand new body, a brand new system, and a brand new idea, not to replace the old, because it's about decentralization, but to offer people an alternative as this unsustainable system is on its way out. So you have your core group of 8 people. Now, what do you do once you got your 8 people? What are the goals here? The goals are to have knowledge and power diffused within that individual structure. So again, we know that there will be natural leaders, people who have certain areas of expertise, and those things will are fine and acceptable, and those will come in handy in a freedom cell. But ultimately, there's no one leader making the decisions and deciding what the freedom cell is going to be about. It's a decision that involves each of the people there. So some of the examples we've been doing in Houston and what we picked up from others in Austin, and there's also people we know in Arizona, there's Colorado, a lot of other cities that I've been contacted by that are working on similar goals. We tried to get our core group first to get up to 3 months worth of backup supply of food for any type of emergency. You know, we're not just planning for government apocalypse, dollar collapse, et cetera. Obviously, those things are all possibilities, and this is helpful for that. But here in Houston, we have hurricanes. You know, wherever you're from, you might have some type of bad weather, and you might end up in some situation. And generations ago, people just prepared. They were my grandmother's generation. You know, that's just how she's grown up, storing things for the winter, storing things down in the cellar, and canning her own food. So we want to have 3 months worth of backup supply of food. We want everybody to have one form of encrypted communication. We want everybody to be proficient in the use of firearms or some other form of self-defense, depending upon what the group is interested in. We would like everybody to be proficient in CPR, to know how to build a fire. So again, you can either use it to share skills among each other. One other way that we've used it is our group met. We meet every couple weeks typically. Our group met up and said, okay, well, we're really interested in permaculture, and we want to do more community gardens and be more involved in that. So let's take this topic. Everybody divide it up. You guys take land. You take water. You take this section. Let's meet again in 2 weeks and come back and teach each other everything we can. So then you're taking that core structure and you're sharing knowledge with each other. You're sharing skills. You're sharing knowledge. And that allows for each individual to be empowered, you know, so that everybody's on the same level. So if one individual gets sick, leaves, passes away, whatever, they're not the only person that knows how to build the fire. They're not the only person that, you know, can save everybody's life, because that's what happens in a lot of groups, is it one person ends up carrying other people's weight, or, you know, you have the problem of the free riders, people who aren't really trying to carry the weight. But this is a very, again, a personal responsibility, a very driven action that is required from people in order to move this forward. Now, looking a bit forward into ways that freedom cells, I believe, could be used as we move further away from statism and towards anarchism, towards voluntarism, is actually in the area of defense. We've seen videos, and we know the videos exist, of police violence and police abuse. What we want to be able to do is to give people the tools that they need in order to be able to actually defend themselves. I don't want to say, you know, fight back. We're not trying to create some sort of insurrectionary war against the police. But imagine this situation. Imagine that a police officer comes into your community and is acting, you know, erratically, violently towards another human being, and you happen to be there witnessing that. And try as you might to ignore it, you just simply can't. You're watching somebody being stomped, and you feel the need to intervene. And you recognize, though, that if you come over to this cop, if you get too close to him, if you rush him, or if you try to disarm, or if you try to do anything, you more than likely might be shot yourself. And the officer will probably get off with beating one person and shooting another, and supposedly in self-defense. So how do you approach that situation then? Because I've played it over in my mind, you know, hundreds of times, and it's not about being the hero. It's just about having compassion, empathy towards another human being. And I don't think that I could just sit there and watch somebody be abused, and I don't want to be abused by a police officer. So what I think we can then do is take this concept of freedom cells, take technology like the app, the application Cell 411, or the Freedom Cell website itself. And the Cell 411 is basically a private, you know, emergency alert system. Basically, it could replace 911, theoretically. So individuals sign up to create cells. They also call them cells on the Cell 411 app. Or you can just send out a public alert, and anybody within range can see. And it'll send out, say, hey, guys, I'm being pulled over. I need some backup. And everybody who's close by, or people in your Freedom Cell, if it's going directly to them, and they're the closest people to you, they can come show up and they can film, right? So things like that are helpful. But imagine the scenario back to somebody being abused. If we had the ability to call in support from our freedom cells, and they come rushing in and they are filming the interaction, maybe you're in a state that it's legal to open carry. So there's people not drawing weapons on an officer, but coming in, making it clear that they're open carrying, being nonviolent, peaceful, but assertive and asserting our rights and making it clear, hey, Houston Police Department, you just abused a member of our community. You're no longer welcome in this community. Send that back to HPD. We're policing our own communities, you know, or disarming the officer, sending them back. Imagine how the authorities would handle that as that started to pop up around the country. And that's the goal of, you know, that's one goal of Freedom Cells. The true goal, though, is to grow this decentralized network. And I think the defense, especially in relation to the ideas of agorism and Samuel Konkin and his theories on how they could play into the real world, that will come, and that will come at a crucial point. It's the ultimate point of whether or not we can sustain ourselves past this status paradigm is if we can defend ourselves. You know, we'll come down to it eventually as being able to defend ourselves. I have some friends who are also focused on developing the freedom cell concept for parents, trying to explain it to more parents in the sense of, say the CPS is trying to come take your kid from you because you chose to smoke a plant, or because you don't want to vaccinate your kids, or because
homeschool. Yeah.
Or your homeschooling, your political beliefs, whatever it could be. And because of that, they are targeting you. So, you know, what are your options? You call in your freedom cell, and if they literally have to put their body on the line and just stand there and surround the house to stop that CPS agent and to keep, you know, your kids there for one more day, maybe that's what it comes down to. I've also seen in Detroit, where the past couple of years, that groups like the Detroit Water Brigade have been fighting against the corporate takeover of their city, and citizens are getting their water shut off. They have actually been able to do, they call them groups of angels. And basically they just call in the groups of angels, and they'll come surround a building when the water trucks try to come turn off some old lady's water. You know, they'll just stop them from doing that because the city's being taken over by corporations. The corporations have the power. They still have water. Yet, you know, a resident who owns, you know, maybe a couple of months worth of back payments gets their water cut off. So
yeah,
there's examples that we can see happen. And I think that's going to come later down the line. Right now, what we're really trying to do is promote the concept, get it out there, because ultimately, like, if you do a Google search right now, Freedom Cells, you're going to see a lot of me and interviews I've done and just talking about this. There really isn't. I'm actually working on an essay right now that's going to put it in text form that'll be really easy to share and to put out, so that people can just, here's the concept, you know, go from there. But what we're really trying to do at this point is just encourage people to join the freedomcells.org website. That's the next step of this. It's the platform that's been built. It's not supposed to just be another social network. That's not what we're promoting it as or asking it to be. Because, and we're not trying to, you know, take over Facebook or have any expectations of that. The true purpose, the ultimate purpose, and I'd say, you know, the main purpose of this website and this platform is to connect with people. When you join, you sign up, you put your interests, like, okay, I'm into urban gardening, or I have these skills, or this is what I want to learn, et cetera. So people can see your profile. Oh, he has an interest in education or politics or, you know, urban gardening, et cetera. And then when you join, there's a map that automatically shows you how many people are within range of you. You've got this many people within 10 miles of you, this and that, so that we can actually foster those relationships and try to start giving people the opportunity to meet like-minded people to create the freedom cells in their area. And also on another level, economically, which freedom cells tie into as well, this will, the website is just a third party that allows people to meet and connect. And maybe once you meet other like-minded people, you start doing agorist gray and black market exchanges that are not taxed, that are not, you know, going through Uncle Sam's dirty hands. So there's really limitless options to what we can do with this. It's also, you know, there's also a possibility that this idea goes nowhere. I think it's a beautiful concept. I think, and I've been putting all my energy into this lately, I think this is the answer for now, to try to create a more free world. But ultimately, it's going to depend on what the people do with it, how we decide to take action or not. You know, if the website...
Oh, we can't hear you. We lost audio. Oh, we can't hear you. Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, cool. The most, you know, if for a year from now, nobody's joined the website and the Freedom Cell movement hasn't grown any, it will only be because we chose not to take action, not because the concept itself isn't capable of and full of potential. So we're asking at this moment for people to go to freedomcells.org. There's several videos that I've done, 10 tips for building a freedom cell, introducing the Freedom Cell Network, shows you how to use the website, organizing against violent cops, talks all about more in depth what I was discussing, using it as a tool to organize against government agents, whether they're IRS, local police officer, or just some criminal. All those videos are on the website, and I just recently did an interview with James Corbett of the Corbett Report talking about this. And we've seen a nice spike in attendance and growth. You can go look through, and I'm looking at right now, we've got Canada, Arizona, Melbourne, Australia, Netherlands, Spain, London, Texas. So, I mean, it's really starting to grow. And the more that I've talked about this in the past 6 to 8 months and been putting the videos out, I've been contacted by people in New Zealand and Sweden, and all really just blowing me away all over the world saying, hey, we just saw your video. We've been doing this for a while, but we don't have a name for it, or we call it this other, et cetera. And again, I don't care what you call it. You can call it whatever you want to call it. The important thing is to get together, to organize, because this is at least going to be one of the ways. I don't want to say, you know, this is the ultimate solution.
Yeah.
Building relationships, encouraging people to get out from behind the computer screen, and recognizing that if we truly do want to take our world in a more empowered place, then we have to take steps in our own lives to make that reality become reality. You know, you can't just survive passively and just, you know, you can sit around and wait to watch it burn if that's your goal. My goal is to
have some set up already. So
exactly. I mean, the goal
easy
is
transition
to
be
proactive and to make sure that not only can we make that easy transition, but when it comes down to it, and we see our brothers and sisters out there who are like making the decision, okay, like I'm going to FEMA because I didn't plan ahead, or go try downtown and go try to loot and ride.
No, come stay with us. Yeah.
We say, here are some seeds. Here's some tools. Let us give you a little bit of food and get you going for those who we can help. But the more people that we have who are actively building these steps now, then when the shit actually hits the fan or the economic collapse happens, or let's say it never even happens, let's not even talk post-apocalyptic. Maybe it never happens.
We built the parallel system that is a better way.
We built a better way to live regardless. Yeah. And that's what I've come to realize in the last 6 years through my activism, is that even if somebody was to somehow prove to me all the things that I've learned are not true and the government's not out to I would say, well, I've already found a more enriching way to live anyway, so I guess I'm still going to pursue this path, you know, and that's what it's really about, is trying to find a valuable way to live that is going to be promoting productivity, that's going to promote self-fulfilling, self-actualization, you know, self-reflection and healing amongst individuals, and also a sense of community. So what we're doing in Houston now is, we have a place now that we are using as the breeding ground, the staging ground, the launch pad for these ideas. We've been talking about it for a few months with videos. We built a website now, encouraging other people to use this concept. And now we're literally going to put it in action. I mentioned the Houston Freethinkers Activist Group earlier. The group's been around for about 6 years now, and we've had two other freethinker houses, what we call the community space. But it's been 2 years since we've done this, and the time just seemed right. It's me and two other guys that are involved in the group. We just recently got this nice house. It's built in the 1930s, a big three-bedroom house, a nice lot with lots of room to grow on and plenty of things to do, and a landlord that's extremely cool and open to us doing all kinds of gardening projects and just doing what we want with it. And knowing that we're using this space as a place to host community meetings, documentary screenings, you know, we want to do house shows, we want to do the Freedom Cell meeting, and use it as a community space. We have a community library here as well. So we're trying to do that, to be here involved in the community, and at the same time, our involvement in the community is also going to be promoting this concept of freedom. So the three of us have agreed that we're going to do at least 2 to 3 weekly updates showing what the Houston Freedom Cell is doing. And again, there's other people involved, but the three of us are living here. So for example, since we've started living here 2 weeks ago, we put out three video updates. First, doing a tour of the house. Here's the house. Here's where we're living. Here's what our goals are for the Freedom Cell and for the house. Then we update, introducing each of our individual selves to the audience and saying, this is my situation. You know, my personal situation. I haven't paid taxes in 6 years, and I'm maybe a bit more free in some areas than a couple of my roommates. Yeah. But I still have room to grow. One of my other roommates, he has a job that, you know, takes 50 hours of his week. He's not necessarily, you know, the most happy about that position, and he'd like to have a more fulfilling way to make gray and black market money outside of the state's hands. So we're going to document his progress as he moves towards that and show people the steps. You know, so we're all in different places individually, but collectively in the house, we're working towards these goals. And it's essentially, if you imagine, a reality style TV show, but and actually DIY.
I like it. Showing, I like it.
Yeah, and showing, you know, the ups and downs. We want to be able, basically the way we're pitching it is, we want to get the bumps and bruises. We want to do all the difficult work and show you guys how to do these things, but we can't do it. You know, we're going to do it in a way that shows you how we take the steps and be honest and say, guys, we tried this experiment. We tried this project.
Yeah.
It backfired, or it didn't. We don't have the knowledge yet. We don't have the skills, or whatever it may be. This is what you can do. And also taking information and learning from the audience and supporters. So far, we've had a lot of growth. Those three videos can be seen on youtube.com/consciousresistance or youtube.com/Houston Freethinkers. Both channels, we're going to be hosting the videos there. We just filmed another update today. We were working in the garden. The garden stuff is definitely going to be a big project as far as us creating alternative sources of income. We're connecting with local restaurants so that we can grow crops specifically that we know will be brought or will be bought by local chefs and restaurants. We're working on brewing our own kombucha, our own brand of like fermented tea that we can sell in some restaurants, and really just try and expand our knowledge and our skills and use these as a way to make income and, of course, empower ourselves. And this is all long-term, working toward land sometime next year, if everything works out. We would like to get land about an hour outside of Houston so that we have the Free Thinker House based in the city for people who are coming in and trying to get involved in the activist side of things. And for those who want to learn more, they can come by for the Garden Sundays. But then those who actually want to take their life like to the next stage, like I'm ready to actually get my building, have the land projects and be able to build an intentional community based on the principles of volunteerism, based on the principles of permaculture, of mindfulness, you know, and all these ideas.
Yeah.
And showing people how it can be done. So right now what we're doing here in the house, all the lessons we're learning, all that information, we're going to document it. And it, as I said earlier, it's going to be going into my last book, the final book in the Conscious Resistance Trilogy. Much of the bulk of that book will be based on what we learned here over these next 6 months to a year and what we do, what you know, what works, what doesn't. And we're going to put that and just put it out there for the world and really try to show people how this idea, is valuable and
excellent.
One of the towards a more free world.
So excellent. Go ahead, Randy.
What I see here is, you have set up, within the confines of the city of Houston, you haven't put a wall up between you and Houston. You haven't put the A flag hanging off of the embassy going, no government, no feds here. You're basically functioning now in a structure parallel to the day-to-day operations of the city of Houston and all of its inhabitants, and you are just basically building your experiment, your incubator, within the confines of the city of Houston, just peacefully coexisting with normal society, so-called, and at the same time kind of incubating these really radical ideas. But most people think, oh, I've got to buy 200 acres of land. I've got to move out in the country. I've got to get the dogs and the guns, and we'll have to, you know, we'll basically have to hole up and put the walls up because the tanks will be rolling in on us eventually. We're flying the A flag out there. But you're not doing that. That's really intriguing.
Yeah. I mean, we'll probably be, that's probably where we'll be next year, you know.
Get the A flag.
But we're, you know, we're trying to play it cool while we're inside the city. And no, but really, we've always seen our strategy, both my individual strategy, and I think the Houston Freethinkers has kind of adopted the same thing, is this one foot in, one foot out mentality. And not in the sense that we even try to really be relevant in the political realm anymore, because it's just, politics is just so much of an obvious sideshow now.
You want to still go ahead. You want to, I talk about this too. You still want to, there's still people you love who are in that system. And so it's really important that you stay connected to it, because at any moment they may be willing to take the leap. And if you're already gone and away from them, it's a lot harder for them. So I always say, whatever, you know, I try, in a different way than you've been doing, I've been trying to extricate myself from as many parts of the system as I can. But I'm, you know, there's lots of people that I still love that are in the system that regardless of whether they ever leave it or not, I'm always going to want to be connected to them. And I think they're also worth trying to convince that, you know, that there's a better way to live. And so I think it's really important to always maintain a connection, you know what I mean, to not completely leave the system and be like, I'm out of here and leave everybody.
Oh, you and I have talked about this a lot. The good things that are in, let's just take cities for an example.
Yeah.
You like to go clubbing. You like to go and dance. There are museums, there's arts, there's vibrant communities within cities that exist as natural network structures. A city itself is a pretty complex organism. It is communities within communities. And, you know, I think what Emily and I have talked about, and I think what you're kind of emulating here as well, Derek, is that we don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, that there are good things about civilization, so-called, and the culture as we have it, that we don't want to throw out, but we don't need to sell our souls to be part of it. We don't have to live under an authoritarian boot heel in order to have the good things of culture.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I think that that's an important point to make as well, is that we can still create the more free world we want, and we can do it in a way that is that allows us to still thrive and survive. Because I think sometimes people think the only way to escape the system is to just, you know, abandon everything. You have to go live in the woods and just let go. I mean, I definitely will say, like, it frustrates me. There's a lot of heaviness on my heart that even though the work I do is important, I still got to use tools like these cell phones and smartphones that are you know, digging up lithium-ion batteries out of the ground and, you know, hurting some indigenous community around the world. There's a lot of things that I'm unhappy about, but I do know that I can create, I can build, I can try to offer alternatives to the current system that we have. And in that space, together, we as free people can find the solutions that do work and that are ethical and that are in line with our values and can allow us to, each of us, to prosper. So it is important to recognize that you know, this, like you said, we don't have to throw it all out. We don't have to do the abandonment, but we can create something better.
Yeah. Work on it every day. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I think the whole thing with the Freedom Cells and we're doing the Free Thinker House, it seems to me like the first step or the early steps in a logical next progression to more micro community than a micro community than a community, and things, I think things like what you're talking about, like having a house in the city and then having space out, you know, outside of the city where people can develop a tiny house community or things like that. I think those are all things. There's a lot of other things going on that are sort of separate and almost have nothing to do with what you're doing, but that very nicely lend themselves to the next step. Are you considering ideas like that for the next logical step after Freedom Cells?
Well, the beautiful thing about this that I really appreciate is that once we move into talking about homesteading, talking about permaculture, talking about land projects, we move away from only speaking to, say, liberty, anarchist, activist. Because then all of a sudden you're speaking to people who maybe they've never heard the message of anarchism. Maybe they've never thought about it. Maybe they, you know, they're into gardening, they're into
living off the grid or whatever,
but they still think that, you know, these candidates are going to change the world or something. So what's cool about that is it allows us to interact with totally new communities because they're not coming from the same background. You know, they may be interested in homesteading, off-grid, and different topics like that, but not quite got that other message. And just in general, it's a different milieu of people. So for us, with the intentional community plan, I want to have a Cobb Hobbit house. I like Cobb.
Yeah.
A little bit on that. So I'd like to have my own little Cobb Hobbit house. We have some people who are involved in the Freedom Cell who have children who are going to do tiny houses for themselves. And so the idea would be for us to build a central kind of the community hub center that we could all operate from and use in different ways. But then at the same time, be able to have our individual.
Yeah, I'm totally into it. Yeah. I'm telling you that.
Use the space from there. Though, as a say, for example, one of the ideas we talked about is once we're there, being able to host monthly markets where we get to sell all the goods that we're producing, let's invite other people to have their craft there, do workshops to show people, oh, here's how we did aquaponics, here's how we did permaculture. So really use it as an educational space, as we learn that we get to teach other people, and really just promote this and hopefully foster the growth of more of these agoras, these conscious agoras, as I'm just
will you explain for our listeners, in case some of them haven't heard of agorism, exactly what that is, and then maybe define your idea of black and gray market. I think everybody pretty much knows what the black market is, but sort of that space between gray and black and whatnot, and agorism.
Sure. So agorism specifically is the agorism or agorism. You may hear that I say it differently sometimes, just depending on how my brain, and also it depends on your accent, I've noticed.
But if you're feeling British today or not,
agorism is probably. I've heard it sound so many different ways. If you're from Philly, you definitely say agorism, the root term is the agora. Samuel E. Compton III, he wrote the book on it called The New Libertarian Manifesto. He wrote this in the late 70s and it was published 79 AD, and he also wrote a second book called The Agorist Agorist Primer. I definitely recommend reading those for those who are interested to get the actual source material on his ideas. But essentially, what he came up with is recognizing what we're discussing here. You know, at that point, the libertarian movement in America, which was born out of the student movement of the 60s, basically decided to form a political party in 1971. And he saw that as a complete selling out of the principles and the ideas that they were espousing of actual change. So he's like, Compton called it partyarchy, people who believe that they were going to somehow create anarchism through parties.
Not that kind of party, anyway.
Yeah, And so he was really critical of these things. And when he was pushed, well, what's your alternative? What's your solution? And he came up with agorism. And in Greece, the agora is the marketplace, you know, the center of activity where people come together to do business. So what he was trying to create using what he called counter-economics is a state, basically the voluntary society, get past the monopoly economy that we have. So, for example, in the United States, we have the Federal Reserve System. If you're tired of supporting the Federal Reserve System, and after, you know, however many years, you finally recognize they're not going to audit the Federal Reserve System. They're not going to
They're not going to audit it.
No bill is going to get passed that's going to do that. So then you're left, well, what can I do? I guess I can either keep using this currency that is working against my interests, or I can find ways to not play that game and to not use their system. And that's where agorism and counter-economics comes in. Konkin called counter-economics basically any economic exchanges that the state cannot touch, either because they're out of their purview or they're technically illegal. So this is where the gray and black markets come in. Gray markets is simply economic exchange is an activity that, while it's technically not illegal, it's maybe you're doing it without the proper licenses, their permissions, their registration, et cetera. So, for example, you know, you get a haircut without the barber being properly licensed. That's right. Gray market activity, right? Technically, you're still using the state's currency. You probably paid Federal Reserve notes, but you didn't give them any taxes. So that's taking some of that power. And that's what Konkin's main goal is, through using counter-economics and the ideas of agorism, we could create these agoras.
And the bartering would be even better, to trade the haircut for something else, right? Exactly. Yeah.
You could bartering, alternative currencies, silver, cryptocurrency, anything that is not using the state's currency, you recognize that that's economic power, and it's taking it out of their hands, and it's injecting it from the status economy into the counter economy, this new alternative. And also in line with that, it wasn't just focused on economics, though. The whole goal is, and this is where the freedom cells come in, you know, essentially I've tried to take the ideas of Konkin and use freedom cell as the mechanism that helps put his ideas into action. Because he says you have to actually build counter institutions. So if you don't support Monsanto and you don't support the pesticides and, you know, the poisoning, the mass industrial farming and industrial farming complexes, your choices are keep using their products, keep buying their products, go out and march and protest, or you can grow your own food. You can support local farmers markets who aren't using pesticides and who aren't connected to those, you know, large industrial mass farms where...
Or just put some seeds in the ground at your house.
And where your food's injected with hormones, all that kind of thing. Exactly. Yeah. So the idea then is that you literally examine, I try to encourage people to do this, like stop, what is your goal? What are you looking for? A more free society? Are you looking to advance freedom in your own life and others? Now, if that's your goal, you know, whatever other goals you have, set those up and look at them, and then look at your life and see which actions that you're taking that are actually bringing you closer to those goals, and which actions are actually contributing to your own enslavement and working against you. And one of the biggest areas is the economics, is the Federal Reserve System, the money system. It's very hard to say that you're against the state and that you oppose them when we still use their dollar every day, or if you're paying taxes. And
it's a huge problem, man.
Not easy things. This is what Konkin talked about. He described phase zero to phase four, like low density, zero agorists. There's total statism. Nobody even knows about freedom. And then he described how in four phases, you know, we could see this slow move towards that. And he wrote this before computers were widely used, but he predicted that technology would come about and help that. And as I mentioned, the Cell 411 app, and obviously tools like we're using right now, obviously we can see that technology can play a role in advancing the counter economy, cryptocurrencies, all these kind of tools that didn't exist 20 or 30 years ago that now give people the opportunity to do business and do exchange. For example, on the Freedom Cell Network, maybe you find somebody close to you and they can post on there, hey, I just grew a bunch of lettuce in my backyard garden. I have some to give out. Is anybody willing to do business with me? You can contact that person and you guys can trade. You can do cryptocurrency. If you choose the Federal Reserve note, whatever. We're not asking for any of that money. We're not paying attention to it. And that can foster counter-economic activity. You know, that's taking power away from the state. It's also building personal relationships and helping us to build and strengthen communities. So agorism is the general philosophy of Samuel Konkin that says, create a more free society. We use the strategy of counter-economics by taking political and economic power away from the state by using the black and gray markets. And of course, this is all in line with the non-aggression principle. Some people, when they hear black market, they think of, you know, shady characters. You think of the mafia or something like
that. Yeah.
But in line with the...
I think of the government, because that's the biggest organized crime operation.
Yeah.
They really are the biggest criminal racket. And the
actually,
thing about
the mafia are much better businessmen, and they're much nicer people.
Yeah, they're actually responsible to their customers.
Exactly.
We were talking earlier about, for example, my drug addiction and recognizing that the drugs that I use and the choices that I made, despite them taking me to prison, I was not committing any violent crime, right? So that was in line with what some people call the non-aggression principle or sovereignty of the individual, mm-hmm. which is essentially saying that you're not doing any harm to anybody in the basic crime if there's no victim. So in line with that, black market activity wouldn't include any violent acts. It wouldn't include theft, at least not in the way that Conkin viewed it. He actually called the red market the area where there's murder for hire, there's violence, there's theft. Those are things that do violate the non-aggression principle. So when you're thinking in terms of gray and black market, gray is the untaxed, unregulated area. Your neighbor mowing your lawn for $10 and nobody, you know, paying a fee for that, or nobody getting taxes out of that. Black market is voluntary prostitution, it's weapons smuggling, it's selling plants like kratom or cannabis that the state deems illegal and doing no harm by doing it. And this is not to say that every single drug dealer out there or every single prostitute on the street is an agorist. They're practicing counter-economics maybe without realizing it. But I've tried to stress to people that what we actually need in order to move the movement forward is a conscious agorist movement. And I mean that in the sense of both conscious on the level of deeper understanding of self, but also in the sense that if you're just out there being a drug dealer, I can't necessarily say that your actions are revolutionary in the sense of somebody who is consciously saying, you know what, through the state, I'm going to sell drugs because I'm going to make money, and I'm going to do it in a way where they're not going to get any of this money. So I'm going to take all my money out of them, and I'm going to refunnel that money into creating counter institutions and to building gardens and giving myself personal power and giving my community power and taking that power away from the state. You know, that's an agorist mindset. That's an agorist mindset. But the other people are merely, while they're doing maybe a good job of keeping money away from the state, they're not quite on the level of a practicing or conscious agorist that we need in order to actually help the philosophical movement grow and put these ideas in. So my main efforts over the last year, and really the main efforts of this, my book and essays that I've been working on, are to promote freedom cells. I very much do believe in the philosophy of agorism, and I can talk about it all night, and I love ideas. But at the end of the day, I don't need people to read the New Libertarian Manifesto. I don't need them to know who Samuel Conkin is. I don't need them to really truly understand that. They get it. People understand the idea of building something new rather than fighting the old system. It's just when you explain that, you say, well, look, you know, this system's kind of screwed up. We can try to change it from within, but I don't see any hope. So instead, let's just redirect all our energy and slowly vacate that system as we build something new. People like that idea. They're just like, okay. Yeah.
I think it's so much more valuable. I think that we need to move. I think it's even time to move past the protesting paradigm, because I think with protests, you have people, I mean, considering that the people who are preying on us are a government parasitic class, when people protest, they're like whipping up all this loosh for the entities to come in and you know, to eat off of. They kind of like that, and it also gives them a reason to clamp down. So rather than spending your energy and your time yelling at your enslavers, I like what I don't know if you know her, I think he's called the Gorilla Gardener. His name's Ron Finley. He says, if I don't march against Monsanto, I spend that day teaching people how to build gardens. It's a better way to spend your time, and you're actually going to have something at the end.
Well, here's what I'm noticing, too. I went on to the Freedom Cell Network website, and I'm looking at the key topic sectors on here, and you have arts and culture, economics, education, governance, health, infrastructure, the whole way down to spirituality. And what I see from this, what struck me is the whole concept of what this is really about is building value in the interests that we have as individuals. You know, most of society now is based on specialization. It's based on vertical systems of integration. It's based on a technocracy that controls and governs the way things are invented, developed, financed, and sent out to market. Whereas organically looking at this type system, your interest in something as a gardener, as an artist, as a musician, as a disc jockey, as somebody who is inventing some new wild-ass free energy system that's going to get us off the grid, These are all things that come together synergistically in this type of situation and allows us to begin to throw value into that and throw off more value than was put into it, if I'm reading exactly where you're going with this, Derek.
Absolutely. Yeah, that was a great analysis. I really appreciate that. And that is exactly true. All these different different topics and interests, they intersect. And through concepts like Freedom Cells, I've seen it in just the bit of work that we've done here in Houston, is those organic interests, they rise to the top and people say, hey, well, I want to focus on this particular aspect. I have this particular angle. And we incorporate that into what our Freedom Cell works on. So that's why I was stressing the decentralized manner, because what happens in one Freedom Cell doesn't necessarily need to happen. You know, the ideas I listed earlier, those are just some things we're working on. It, depending on your environment, your conditions, your needs, your goals, it might look completely different, and that's perfectly fine. And that's the beautiful thing about it is, you know, I'm here as a representative of the Houston Freedom Cell, speaking as one individual, as part of a larger whole. So my ideas are just my own. But at the end of the day, what we decide and what that Freedom Cell becomes depends on the people who take action and step up to that plate. And the beautiful thing is there's such a wide range of interests within that. It kind of pushes and pulls in different directions, but it does it organically. There's no, you know, other force doing it other than the force of the people who are involved and the creativity of those people who are choosing to take those steps. And that is where we're seeing true organic flourishing and ideas. And I mean, that's what the space really has been. I'm just very excited for everybody who will be following our journey here in the Freethinker House, because in the 2 weeks that we've been here, we've already just really dove in, and we each have a little bit of experience in some of these areas background, but now we're putting all our heads together in a single space, and the ideas have been flowing. The potential is really there. We're extremely excited to share our progress with you guys and to show that this concept can be put into action. And I hope through that we'll inspire other people. And we've already been seeing a growth on the Freedom Cell website and seeing new people plug in and join. And it's an exciting time. I really do think this is how I keep myself from being stressed out by all the other creators.
Yeah.
I just stay plugged into the people who are working on beautiful things and try to do as much good as I can in that area. And when you do that and you actually start taking these steps, it's much easier to step back and not to just let go, because, the world definitely has a lot of issues to work on. But to be aware that I'm taking steps in my own life that are going to help myself and help other people. And when you know that, it's so much easier to stay in that sense of balance, because the state, the system, the new world order, whatever name you want to attach to this thing, the parasite,
would
like us to be in balance. They would like us to be divided, like we were talking about earlier. They would like us to be fearful, to be worried about what solutions are there. And there's always going to be something to worry about. There's always going to be some fear to tap into if you choose to do so. But you can also choose to tap into this new paradigm and tap into the potential that exists within your own heart, your own mind, and your own community by taking action and getting involved. And I really, really, truly believe that Freedom Cells is going to be one of the avenues that will take us to this more free place.
All right. I think we come to a good place to wrap it up. I want to say thank you very much, Derek. I really hope people will check out your work. Keep doing what you're doing. I think you're doing an excellent job. You've been a part of my journey here to get to where I'm at now, and I think you're one of the most well-meaning and genuine people in the independent media and in this movement. Keep doing what you're doing. We'd love to have you back sometime to hear how progress is going on this project. And Randy, do you have anything else to say?
Yeah, we're going to be watching what you're doing. I'm looking forward to watching the whole experiment that you're doing down in Houston right now. And I'm very interested to see how the Freedom Cells thing is going to begin to propagate out, and we'll try to do everything we can to share the information that you've shared today with us, get it out to other people. Touch back with us as things, you know, start to happen and develop. And let's kind of develop this network together, because I'm very psyched by what I've heard over the last 2 hours. I'm hopeful.
Awesome. I thank you guys very much for letting me come on. I really do appreciate it. And I'm happy to come back anytime. We're definitely trying to put out progress reports to everybody. And I'm happy to develop it together. So I really appreciate you guys giving me the chance to speak what we're working on.
Absolutely. And right. Stay on the line for a second, Derek. And as we're on the way out here, I have a track, Free Thinker by the artist Sergey Orange. Randy?
Yeah, that's going to wrap it up for this time. Our guest, Derek Bros, the website, theconsciousresistance.com. All the links and other good stuff baked into the bottom of the YouTube thing down there, or the webpage where you're reading it. I'm Randy Moggins for Off Planet Radio with Emily Moyer, Derek Bros, our guest. The website is offplanetradio.com. The truth is out there. It's inside you. Now, go connect with somebody.